The Two Towers, Disc 4.
They had been going for a long while.
Pippin had tried to keep count of the Ent strides, but had failed, getting lost at about 3,000 when Treebeard began to slacken his pace. Suddenly he stopped, put the hobbits down, and raised his curled hands to his mouth so that they made a hollow tube. Then he blew or called through them.
A great hum, hum, rang out like a deep-throated horn in the woods, and seemed to echo from the trees. Far off there came from several directions a similar hum, hum, hum. That was not an echo, but an answer. Treebeard now perched Merry and Pippin on his shoulders, and strode on again, every now and then sending out another horn call, and each time the answers came louder and nearer. In this way they came at last to what looked like an impenetrable wall of dark evergreen trees, trees of a kind that the hobbits had never seen before. They branched out right from the roots, and were densely clad in dark, glossy leaves like thornless holly, and they bore many stiff, upright flower spikes with large, shining, olive-coloured buds. Turning to the left and skirting this huge hedge, Treebeard came in a few strides to a narrow entrance. Through it a worn path passed, and dived suddenly down a long, steep slope. The hobbits saw that they were descending into a great dingle, almost as round as a bowl, very wide and deep, crowned at the rim with a high, dark, evergreen hedge. It was smooth and grass-clad inside, and there were no trees except three very tall and beautiful silver birches that stood at the bottom of the bowl. Two other paths led down into the dingle, from the west and from the east. Several Ents had already arrived. More were coming in down the other paths, and some were now following Treebeard. As they drew near, the hobbits gazed at them. They had expected to see a number of creatures as much like Treebeard as one hobbit is like another, at any rate to a stranger's eye, and they were very much surprised to see nothing of the kind. The Ents were as different from one another as trees from trees, some as different as one tree is from another of the same name, but quite different growth and history, and some as different as one tree kind from another, as birch from beech, oak from fir. There were a few older Ents, bearded and gnarled like hale but ancient trees, though none looked as ancient as Treebeard. And there were tall, strong Ents, clean-limbed and smooth-skinned like forest trees in their prime. But there were no young Ents, no saplings. Altogether there were about 24 standing on the wide grassy floor of the dingle, and as many more were marching in. At first Merry and Pippin were struck chiefly by the variety that they saw, the many shapes and colours, the differences in girth and height and length of leg and arm, and in the number of toes and fingers, anything from 3 to 9. A few seemed more or less related to Treebeard, and reminded them of beech trees or oaks. But there were other kinds. Some recalled the chestnut, brown-skinned Ents with large, splay-fingered hands and short, thick legs. Some recalled the ash, tall, straight grey Ents with many-fingered hands and long legs. Some the fir, the tallest Ents, and others the birch, the rowan, and the linden. But when the Ents all gathered round Treebeard, bowing their heads slightly, murmuring in their slow musical voices, and looking long and intently at the strangers, then the hobbits saw that they were all of the same kindred, and all had the same eyes. Not all so old or so deep as Treebeard's, but all with the same slow, steady, thoughtful expression, and the same green flicker. As soon as the whole company was assembled, standing in a wide circle round Treebeard, a curious and unintelligible conversation began. The Ents began to murmur slowly. First one joined and then another, until they were all chanting together in a long rising and falling rhythm, now louder on one side of the ring, now dying away there and rising to a great boom on the other side. Though he could not catch or understand any of the words, he supposed the language was Entish. Pippin found the sound very pleasant to listen to at first,
but gradually his attention wavered. After a long time, and the chant showed no signs of slackening, he found himself wondering, since Entish was such an unhasty language, whether they had yet got further than good morning, and if Treebeard was to call the roll, how many days it would take to sing all their names. "I wonder what the Entish is for yes or no," he thought. He yawned. Treebeard was immediately aware of him.
"Hmm, ha, hey, my Pippin,"
he said, and the other Ents all stopped their chant.
"You are a hasty folk, I was forgetting, and anyway it is wearisome listening to a speech you do not understand. You may get down now. I've told your names to the Entmoot, and they have seen you, and they have agreed that you are not orcs, and that a new line shall be put in the old lists. We have got no further yet, but that is quick work for an Entmoot. Now you and Merry can stroll about in the dingle, if you like. There is a well of good water, if you need refreshing, away yonder in the north bank. There are still some words to speak before the moot really begins. I will come and see you again, and tell you how things are going."
He put the hobbits down. Before they walked away, they bowed low. This feat seemed to amuse the Ents very much, to judge by the tone of their murmurs and the flicker of their eyes, but they soon turned back to their own business. Merry and Pippin climbed up the path that came in from the west and looked through the opening in the great hedge. Long tree-clad slopes rose from the lip of the dingle, and away beyond them, above the fir trees of the furthest ridge, there rose, sharp and white, the peak of a high mountain. Southwards to the left they could see the forest falling away down into the grey distance. There, far away, there was a pale green glimmer that Merry guessed to be a glimpse of the plains of Rohan. "I wonder where Isengard is," said Pippin. "I don't know quite where we are," said Merry, "but that peak is probably Methaedras, and as far as I can remember the ring of Isengard lies in a fork or deep cleft at the end of the mountains. It is probably down behind this great ridge. There seems to be a smoke or haze over there, left of the peak, don't you think?" "What is Isengard like?" said Pippin. "I wonder what Ents can do about it anyway."
"So do I," said Merry.
"Isengard is a sort of ring of rocks or hills, I think, with a flat space inside and an island or pillar of rock in the middle called Orthanc. Saruman has a tower on it. There is a gate, perhaps more than one, in the encircling wall, and I believe there is a stream running through it. It comes out of the mountains and flows on across the gap of Rohan. It doesn't seem the sort of place for Ents to tackle. But I have an odd feeling about these Ents. Somehow I don't think they're quite as safe and, well, funny as they seem. They seem slow, queer, and patient, almost sad, and yet I believe they could be roused. If that happened, I'd rather not be on the other side."
"Yes," said Pippin, "I know what you mean. There might be all the difference between an old cow sitting and thoughtfully chewing and a bull charging, and the change might come suddenly. I wonder if Treebeard will rouse them. I'm sure he means to try. But they don't like being roused. Treebeard got roused himself last night, and then bottled it up again."
The hobbits turned back. The voices of the Ents were still rising and falling in their conclave. The sun had now risen high enough to look over the high hedges. It gleamed on the tops of the birches and lit the northward side of the dingle with a cool yellow light. There they saw a little glittering fountain. They walked along the rim of the great bowl at the feet of the evergreens. It was pleasant to feel cool grass about their toes again, and not to be in a hurry. And then they climbed down to the gushing water. They drank a little, a clean, cold, sharp draught, and sat down on a mossy stone, watching the patches of sun on the grass and the shadows of the sailing clouds passing over the floor of the dingle. The murmur of the Ents went on. It seemed a very strange and remote place, outside their world, and far from everything that had ever happened to them. A great longing came over them for the faces and voices of their companions, especially for Frodo and Sam and for Strider.
At last there came a pause in the Ent voices, and looking up, they saw Treebeard coming towards them with another Ent at his side.
Hum, here I am again, said Treebeard. Are you getting weary or feeling impatient, Well, I'm afraid that you must not get impatient yet. We've finished the first stage now, but I've still got to explain things again to those that live a long way off, far from Isengard, and those that I could not get round to before the moot, and after that we shall have to decide what to do. However, deciding what to do does not take Ents so long as going over all the facts and events that they have to make up their minds about. Still, it's no use denying we shall be here a long time yet, a couple of days, very likely. So I've brought you a companion. He has an Ent-house nearby. Bregolard is his elvish name. He says he has already made up his mind and does not need to remain at the moot. He is the nearest thing about us to a hasty Ent. You ought to get on together. Goodbye.
Treebeard turned and left them. Bregolard stood for some time surveying the hobbits solemnly, and they looked at him, wondering when he would show any signs of hastiness. He was tall, and seemed to be one of the younger Ents. He had smooth, shining skin on his arms and legs. His lips were ruddy, and his hair was grey-green. He could bend and sway like a slender tree in the wind. At last he spoke, and his voice, though resonant, was higher and clearer than Treebeard's.
My friends, let us go for a walk, he said. I am Bregolard. That is Quickbeam in your language, but it is only a nickname, of course. They have called me that ever since I said yes to an elder Ent before he had finished his question. Also I drink quickly and go out while some are still wetting their beards. Come with me.
He reached down two shapely arms and gave a long-fingered hand to each of the hobbits. All that day they walked about in the woods with him, singing and laughing, for Quickbeam often laughed. He laughed if the sun came out from behind a cloud, he laughed if they came upon a stream or spring. Then he stooped and splashed his feet and head with water. He laughed sometimes at some sound or whisper in the trees. Whenever he saw a rowan tree, he halted a while with his arms stretched out, and sang, and swayed as he sang. At nightfall he brought them to his Ent-house. Nothing more than a mossy stone set upon turves under a green bank. Rowan trees grew in a circle about it, and there was water, as in all Ent-houses, a spring bubbling out from the bank. They talked for a while as darkness fell on the forest. Not far away the voices of the Entmoot could be heard still going on, but now they seemed deeper and less leisurely, and every now and again one great voice would rise in a high and quickening music, while all the others died away. But beside them Bregolard spoke gently in their own tongue, almost whispering, and they learned that he belonged to Skinbark's people, and the country where they had lived had been ravaged. That seemed to the hobbits quite enough to explain his hastiness, at least in the matter of orcs.
"There were rowan trees in my home," said Bregolard, softly and sadly. "Rowan trees that took root when I was an Enting, many, many years ago in the quiet of the world. The oldest were planted by the Ents to try and please the Entwives, but they looked at them and smiled and said that they knew where whiter blossom and richer fruit were growing. Yet there are no trees of all that race, the people of the Rose, that are so beautiful to me. And these trees grew and grew, till the shadow of each was like a green hall, and their red berries in the autumn were a burden, and a beauty and a wonder. Birds used to flock there. I like birds, even when they chatter, and the rowan has enough and to spare. But the birds became unfriendly and greedy, and tore at the trees, and threw the fruit down, and did not eat it. Then orcs came with axes and cut down my trees. I came and called them by their long names, but they did not quiver, they did not hear or answer, they lay dead. O orafane, lasemista, carne mirie, O rowan fair, upon your hair how white the blossom lay, O rowan mine, I saw you shine upon a summer's day, your rind so bright, your leaves so light, your voice so cool and soft. Upon your head how golden red the crown you bore aloft, O rowan dead, upon your head your hair is dry and grey, your crown is spilled, your voice is still for ever and a day. O orafarne, lasemista, carne mirie.
The hobbits fell asleep to the sound of the soft singing of Bregolad, that seemed to lament in many tongues the fall of trees that he had loved. The next day they spent also in his company, but they did not go far from his house. Most of the time they sat silent under the shelter of the bank, for the wind was colder, and the clouds were closer and greyer. There was little sunshine, and in the distance the voices of the Ents at the moot still rose and fell, sometimes loud and strong, sometimes low and sad, sometimes quickening, sometimes slow and solemn as a dirge. A second night came, and still the Ents held conclave under hurrying clouds and fitful stars. The third day broke, bleak and windy. At sunrise the Ents' voices rose to a great clamour and then died down again. As the morning wore on, the wind fell and the air grew heavy with expectancy. The hobbits could see that Bregolad was now listening intently, although to them, down in the dell of his Enthouse, the sound of the moot was faint. The afternoon came, and the sun, going west towards the mountains, sent out long yellow beams between the cracks and fissures of the clouds. Suddenly they were aware that everything was very quiet. The whole forest stood in listening silence. Of course, the Ent voices had stopped. What did that mean? Bregolad was standing up erect and tense, looking back northwards towards Derndingle. Then with a crash came a great ringing shout.
Rahumra!
The trees quivered and bent as if a gust had struck them. There was another pause, and then a marching music began like solemn drums, and above the rolling beats and booms there welled voices singing high and strong.
We come with roll of drum, ta-run-da-run-da-run-da-rum.
The Ents were coming. Ever nearer and louder rose their song.
We come with horn and drum, ta-roon-a-roon-a-rum.
Bregolad picked up the hobbits and strode from his house. Before long they saw the marching line approaching. The Ents were swinging along with great strides down the slope towards them. Treebeard was at their head, and some 50 followers behind him, two abreast, keeping step with their feet and beating time with their hands upon their flanks. As they drew near, the flash and flicker of their eyes could be seen.
"Hum, hum, here we come with the boom, here we come at last!" called Treebeard when he caught sight of Bregolad and the hobbits. "Come, join the moot. We are off to Isengard!" "To Isengard!"
the Ents cried in many voices.
"To Isengard!" To Isengard, though Isengard be ringed and barred with doors of stone, though Isengard be strong and hard, as cold as stone and bare as bone. We go, to war, to hew the stone and break the door, for bowl and bow are burning now, the furnace roars, we go to war. To land of gloom, with tramp of doom, with roll of drum, we come, to Isengard, with doom we come, with doom we come."
So they sang as they marched southwards. Bregolad, his eyes shining, swung into the line beside Treebeard. The old Ent now took the hobbits back, and set them on his shoulders again, and so they rode proudly at the head of the singing company with beating hearts and heads held high. Though they had expected something to happen eventually, they were amazed at the change that had come over the Ents. It seemed now as sudden as the bursting of a flood that had long been held back by a dike.
"The Ents have made up their minds rather quickly, after all, didn't they?"
Pippin ventured to say after some time, when for a moment the singing paused, and only the beating of hands and feet was heard.
"Quickly?" said Treebeard. "Yes, indeed, quicker than I expected. Indeed, I have not seen them roused like this for many an age. We Ents do not like being roused, and we never are roused unless it is clear to us that our trees and our lives are in great danger. That has not happened in this forest since the wars of Sauron and the Men of the Sea. It is the orc work, the wanton hewing, rorum, without even the bad excuse of feeding the fires that has so angered us, and the treachery of a neighbour who should have helped us. Wizards ought to know better. They do know better. There is no curse in Elvish, Entish, or the tongues of men bad enough for such treachery. Down with Saruman!"
"Will you really break the doors of Isengard?" asked Merry.
"Well, we could, you know. You do not know, perhaps, how strong we are. Maybe you have heard of trolls. They are mighty strong, but trolls are only counterfeits made by the enemy in the great darkness in mockery of Ents, as orcs were of elves. We are stronger than trolls. We are made of the bones of the earth. We can split stones like the roots of trees, only quicker, far quicker, if our minds are roused. If we are not hewn down, or destroyed by fire or blast of sorcery, we could split Isengard into splinters and crack its walls into rubble."
"But Saruman will try to stop you, won't he?"
Yes, that is so. I have not forgotten it. Indeed, I have thought long about it. But, you see, many of the Ents are younger than I am, by many lives of trees. They are all roused now, and their mind is all on one thing, breaking Isengard. But they will start thinking again before long. They will cool down a little when we take our evening drink. What a thirst we shall have! But let them march now and sing. We have a long way to go, and there is time ahead for thought. It is something to have started."
Treebeard marched on, singing with the others for a while, but after a time his voice died to a murmur and fell silent again. Pippin could see that his old brow was wrinkled and knotted. At last he looked up, and Pippin could see a sad look in his eyes, sad but not unhappy. There was a light in them, as if the green flame had sunk deeper into the dark wells of his thought.
"Of course it is likely enough, my friends," he said slowly, "likely enough that we are going to our doom, the last march of the Ents. But if we stayed at home and did nothing, doom would find us anyway, sooner or later. That thought has long been growing in our hearts, and that is why we are marching now. It was not a hasty resolve. Now at least the last march of the Ents may be worth a song. Aye," he sighed, "we may help the other peoples before we pass away. Still, I should have liked to see the songs come true about the Entwives. I should dearly have liked to see Fimbrethel again. But there, my friends, songs like trees bear fruit only in their own time and their own way, and sometimes they are withered untimely."
The Ents went striding on at a great pace. They had descended into a long fold of the land that fell away southward. Now they began to climb up and up, on to the high western ridge. The woods fell away, and they came to scattered groups of birch, and then to bare slopes where only a few gaunt pine trees grew. The sun sank behind the dark hill back in front. Grey dusk fell. Pippin looked behind. The number of the Ents had grown, or what was happening? Where the dim, bare slopes that they had crossed should lie, he thought he saw groves of trees, but they were moving. Could it be that the trees of Fangorn were awake, and the forest was rising, marching over the hills to war? He rubbed his eyes, wondering if sleep and shadow had deceived him, but the great grey shapes moved steadily onward. There was a noise like wind in many branches. The Ents were drawing near the crest of the ridge now, and all song had ceased. Night fell, and there was silence. Nothing was to be heard save a faint quiver of the earth beneath the feet of the Ents, and a rustle, the shade of a whisper as of many drifting leaves. At last they stood upon the summit, and looked down into a dark pit, the great cleft at the end of the mountains. Nan Kurunir, the valley of Saruman.
Night lies over Isengard, said Treebeard.
Chapter 5. The White Rider.
My very bones are chilled,
said Gimli, flapping his arms and stamping his feet. Day had come at last. At dawn the companions had made such breakfast as they could. Now in the growing light they were getting ready to search the ground again for signs of the hobbits.
And do not forget that old man, said Gimli. I should be happier if I could see the print of a boot.
Why would that make you happy? Said Legolas.
Because an old man with feet that leave marks might be no more than he seemed, answered the dwarf.
Maybe, said the elf, but a heavy boot might leave no print here. The grass is deep and springy.
That would not baffle a ranger, said Gimli. A bent blade is enough for Aragorn to read. But I do not expect him to find any traces. It was an evil phantom of Saruman that we saw last night. I am sure of it, even under the light of morning. His eyes are looking out on us from Fangorn even now, maybe.
It is likely enough, said Aragorn. Yet I'm not sure. I'm thinking of the horses. You said last night, Gimli, that they were scared away. But I didn't think so. Did you hear them, Legolas?
Did they sound to you like beasts in terror?
No, said Legolas. I heard them clearly. But for the darkness and our own fear, I should have guessed that they were beasts wild with some sudden gladness. They spoke as horses will when they meet a friend that they have long missed.
So I thought, said Aragorn. But I can't read the riddle unless they return. Come, the light is growing fast. Let us look first and guess later. We should begin here, near to our own camping ground, searching carefully all about, and working up the slope towards the forest. To find the hobbits is our errand, whatever we may think of our visitor in the night.
If they escaped by some chance, then they must have hidden in the trees, or they would have been seen.
If we find nothing between here and the eaves of the wood, then we'll make a last search upon the battlefield and among the ashes. But there's little hope there. The horsemen of Rohan did their work too well.
For some time the companions crawled and groped upon the ground. The tree stood mournfully above them, its dry leaves now hanging limp and rattling in the chill easterly wind. Aragorn moved slowly away. He came to the ashes of the watchfire near the river bank, and then began to retrace the ground back towards the knoll where the battle had been fought. Suddenly he stooped and bent low with his face almost in the grass. Then he called to the others. They came running up.
"Here at last we find news," said Aragorn.
He lifted up a broken leaf for them to see, a large pale leaf of golden hue, now fading and turning brown.
"Here is a Malorn leaf of Lorien, and there are small crumbs on it, and a few more crumbs in the grass. And see! There are some pieces of cut cord lying nearby.
And here is the knife that cut them, said Gimli.
He stooped and drew out of a tussock, into which some heavy foot had trampled it, a short, jagged blade. The haft from which it had been snapped was beside it.
It is an orc weapon, he said, holding it gingerly,
and looking with disgust at the carved handle. It had been shaped like a hideous head with squinting eyes and leering mouth.
"Well, here is the strangest riddle that we've yet found," exclaimed Legolas. "A bound prisoner escapes both from the orcs and from the surrounding horsemen. He then stops, while still in the open, and cuts his bonds with an orc knife. But how and why? For if his legs were tied, how did he walk? And if his arms were tied, how did he use the knife? And if neither were tied, Why did he cut the cords at all? Being pleased with his skill, he then sat down and quietly ate some whey bread. That at least is enough to show that he was a hobbit, without the mallorn leaf. After that, I suppose, he turned his arms into wings and flew away singing into the trees. It should be easy to find him. We only need wings ourselves.
There was sorcery here right enough, said Gimli. What was that old man doing? What have you to say, Aragorn, to the reading of Legolas? Can you better it?
Maybe I could, said Aragorn, smiling. There are some other signs near at hand that you have not considered. I agree that the prisoner was a hobbit, and must have had either legs or hands free before he came here.
I guess that it was hands, because the riddle then becomes easier, and also because, as I read the marks, he was carried to this point by an orc. Blood was spilled there, a few paces away, orc blood. There are deep prints of hooves all about this spot, and signs that a heavy thing was dragged away. The orc was slain by horsemen, and later his body was hauled to the fire. But the hobbit was not seen. He was not in the open, for it was night, and he still had his elven cloak. He was exhausted and hungry, and it's not to be wondered at that when he had cut his bonds with the knife of his fallen enemy, he rested and ate a little before he crept away. But it's a comfort to know that he had some lembas in his pocket, even though he ran away without gear or pack. That, perhaps, is like a hobbit.
I say he, though I hope and guess that both Merry and Pippin were here together. There is, however, nothing to show that for certain.
And how do you suppose that either of our friends came to have a hand free?
Asked Gimli. I don't know how it happened, answered Aragorn. Nor do I know why an orc was carrying them away. Not to help them to escape, we may be sure. Nay, rather I think that I now begin to understand a matter that has puzzled me from the beginning. Why, when Boromir had fallen, were the orcs content with the capture of Merry and Pippin?
They didn't seek out the rest of us, nor attack our camp, but instead they went with all speed towards Isengard.
Did they suppose that they had captured the ring-bearer and his faithful comrades?
I think not.
Their masters would not dare to give such plain orders to orcs, even if they knew so much themselves. They would not speak openly to them of the ring. They are not trusty servants.
But I think the orcs had been commanded to capture hobbits alive at all costs.
An attempt was made to slip out with the precious prisoners before the battle. Treachery, perhaps, likely enough with some folk. Some large and bold orc may have been trying to escape with the prize alone, for his own ends. There, that's my tale. Others might be devised, but on this we may count in any case. One at least of our friends escaped. It's our task to find him and help him before we return to Rohan. We must not be daunted by Fangorn, since need drove him into that dark place.
I don't know which taunts me more, Fangorn, or the thought of the long road through Rohan on foot, said Gimli.
Then let us go to the forest, said Aragorn. It wasn't long before Aragorn found fresh signs. At one point, near the bank of the Entwash, he came upon footprints, hobbit prints, but too light for much to be made of them. Then again, beneath the bole of a great tree on the very edge of the wood, more prints were discovered. The earth was bare and dry, and didn't reveal much.
One hobbit at least stood here for a while and looked back, and then he turned away into the forest, said Aragorn. Then we must go in too, said Gimli. But I don't like the look of this, Fangorn, and we were warned against it. I wish the chase had led anywhere else.
I don't think the wood feels evil, whatever tales may say, said Legolas. He stood under the eaves of the forest, stooping forward, as if he were listening, and peering with wide eyes into the shadows. No, it's not evil. Or what evil is in it is far away. I catch only the faintest echoes of dark places where the hearts of the trees are black. There is no malice near us, but there is watchfulness and anger.
Well, it has no cause to be angry with me, said Gimli. I've done it no harm.
"'That's just as well,' said Legolas. "'But none the less it has suffered harm. "'There is something happening inside, or going to happen. "'Do you not feel the tenseness? "'It takes my breath.'
"'I feel the air is stuffy,' said the dwarf. "'This wood is lighter than Mirkwood, but it's musty and shabby.'
"'It's old, very old,' said the elf. "'So old that almost I feel young again, "'as I have not felt since I journeyed with you children. "'It's old and full of memory. "'I could have been happy here if I'd come in days of peace.'
"'I dare say you could,' snorted Gimli. "'You're a wood elf. "'Anyway, though elves of any kind are strange folk, "'yet you comfort me. "'Where you go, I'll go. "'But keep your bow ready to hand.' "'And I'll keep my axe loose in my belt, not for use on trees,' he added hastily, looking up at the tree under which they stood. "'I don't wish to meet that old man at unawares without an argument ready to hand. That's all. Let's go.'
With that the three hunters plunged into the forest of Fangorn. Legolas and Gimli left the tracking to Aragorn. There was little for him to see. The floor of the forest was dry and covered with a drift of leaves, but guessing that the fugitives would stay near the water, he returned often to the banks of the stream. So it was that he came upon the place where Merry and Pippin had drunk and bathed their feet. There, plain for all to see, were the footprints of two hobbits, one somewhat smaller than the other.
"'This is good tidings,' said Aragorn. "'Yet the marks are 2 days old,' "'And it seems that at this point the hobbits left the waterside.' "'Then what should we do now?' said Gimli. "'We can't pursue them through the whole fastness of Fangorn. "'We've come ill-supplied. "'If we don't find them soon, we shall be of no use to them, "'except to sit down beside them and show our friendship by starving together.'
"'If that's indeed all we can do, then we must do it,' said Aragorn. "'Let us go on.' They came at length to the steep, abrupt end of Treebeard's Hill, and looked up at the rock wall with its rough steps leading to the high shelf. Gleams of sun were striking through the hurrying clouds, and the forest now looked less grey and drear. "'Let us go up and look about us,' said Legolas. "'I still feel my breath short.' The companions climbed up. Aragorn came last, moving slowly. He was scanning the steps and ledges closely.
"'I'm almost sure that the hobbits have been up here,' he said. "'But there are other marks, very strange marks, which I don't understand. "'I wonder if we can see anything from this ledge "'which will help us to guess which way they went next.' "'He stood up and looked about, "'but he saw nothing that was of any use. "'The shelf faced southward and eastward, "'but only on the east was the view open.' There he could see the heads of the trees descending in ranks towards the plain from which they had come.
"'We've journeyed a long way round,' said Legolas. "'We could have all come here safe together if we'd left the great river on the second or third day and struck west. Few can foresee whither their road will lead them till they come to its end.'
"'But we didn't wish to come to Fangorn,' said Gimli.
"'Yet here we are, and nicely caught in the net,' said Legolas. "'Look!'
"'Look at what?' said Gimli.
"'There in the trees.'
"'Where? I've not elf eyes. Hush! Speak more softly. Look!'
said Legolas, pointing. "'Down in the wood. Back in the way that we've just come. It is he. Cannot you see him? Passing from tree to tree?'
"'I see. I see him now,' hissed Gimli. "'Look, Aragorn. Did I not warn you? There's the old man.' "'All in dirty grey rags. That's why I couldn't see him at first.'
"'Aragorn looked and beheld a bent figure moving slowly. "'It wasn't far away. "'It looked like an old beggar man, walking wearily, leaning on a rough staff. "'His head was bowed, and he didn't look towards them. "'In other lands they would have greeted him with kind words, "'but now they stood silent, each feeling a strange expectancy.' Something was approaching that held a hidden power, or menace. Gimli gazed with wide eyes for a while, as step by step the figure drew nearer,
Then suddenly, unable to contain himself longer, he burst out,
"Your bow, Legolas, bend it, get ready, it's Saruman. Do not let him speak or put a spell upon us. Shoot first."
Legolas took his bow and bent it, slowly and as if some other will resisted him. He held an arrow loosely in his hand, but did not fit it to the string. Aragorn stood silent. His face was watchful and intent.
"Why are you waiting? What's the matter with you?" said Gimli in a hissing whisper.
"Legolas is right," said Aragorn quietly.
"We may not shoot an old man so, at unawares and unchallenged. Whatever fear or doubt be on us, watch and wait."
At that moment the old man quickened his pace and came with surprising speed to the foot of the rock wall. Then suddenly he looked up, while they stood motionless looking down. There was no sound. They couldn't see his face. He was hooded, and above the hood he wore a wide-brimmed hat, so that all his features were overshadowed, except for the end of his nose and his grey beard. Yet it seemed to Aragorn that he caught the gleam of eyes keen and bright from within the shadow of the hooded brows. At last the old man broke the silence.
"Well met indeed, my friends," he said in a soft voice. "I wish to speak to you. Will you come down, or shall I come up?"
Without waiting for an answer, he began to climb.
"Now," said Gimli, "stop him, Legolas."
"Did I not say that I wished to speak to you?" said the old man. "Put away that bow, Master Elf."
The bow and arrow fell from Legolas's hands, and his arms hung loose at his sides.
"And you, Master Dwarf, pray take your hand from your axe haft till I am up. You will not need such arguments."
Gimli started, and then stood still as stone, staring, while the old man sprang up the rough steps as nimbly as a goat. All weariness seemed to have left him. As he stepped up onto the shelf, there was a gleam, too brief for certainty, a quick glint of white, as if some garment shrouded by the grey rags had been for an instant revealed. The intake of Gimli's breath could be heard as a loud hiss in the silence.
"Well met, I say again," said the old man, coming towards them.
When he was a few feet away, he stood, stooping over his staff, with his head thrust forward, peering at them from under his hood.
"And what may you be doing in these parts? An elf, a man, and a dwarf, all clad in elvish fashion? No doubt there's a tale worth hearing behind it all. Such things are not often seen here."
"You speak as one who knows Fangorn well," said Aragorn. "Is that so?"
"Not well," said the old man. "That would be the study of many lives. But I come here now and again."
"May we know your name, and then hear what it is that you have to say to us?" said Aragorn. "The morning passes, and we have an errand that will not wait."
"As for what I wished to say, I've said it. What may you be doing, and what tale can you tell of yourselves? As for my name..."
He broke off, laughing long and softly. Aragorn felt a shudder run through him at the sound, a strange cold thrill, and yet it was not fear or terror that he felt. Rather it was like the sudden bite of a keen air, or the slap of cold rain that wakes up an uneasy sleeper.
"My name," said the old man again, "have you not guessed it already? You've heard it before, I think. Yes, you've heard it before. But come now, what of your tale?"
The three companions stood silent and made no answer.
"There are some who'd begin to doubt whether your errand is fit to tell," said the old man. "Happily, I know something of it. You are tracking the footsteps of two young hobbits, I believe. Yes, hobbits. Don't stare, as if you'd never heard the strange name before. You have, and so have I. Well, they climbed up here the day before yesterday, and they met someone they didn't expect. Does that comfort you? And now you'd like to know where they were taken? Well, well, maybe I can give you some news about that. But why are we standing? Your errand, you see, is no longer as urgent as you thought. Let us sit down and be more at ease."
The old man turned away and went towards a heap of fallen stones and rock at the foot of the cliff behind. Immediately, as if a spell had been removed, the others relaxed and stirred.
Gimli's hand went at once to his axe-haft. Aragorn drew his sword. Legolas picked up his bow. The old man took no notice, but stooped and sat himself on a low flat stone. Then his grey cloak drew apart, and they saw, beyond a doubt, that he was clothed beneath all in white.
"Saruman!" cried Gimli, springing towards him with axe in hand. "Speak! Tell us where you've hidden our friends. What have you done with them? Speak, or I will make a dint in your hat that even a wizard will find it hard to deal with."
The old man was too quick for him. He sprang to his feet and leapt to the top of a large rock. There he stood, grown suddenly tall, towering above them. His hood and his grey rags were flung away. His white garments shone. He lifted up his staff, and Gimli's axe leapt from his grasp and fell ringing on the ground. The sword of Aragorn, stiff in his motionless hand, blazed with a sudden fire. Legolas gave a great shout and shot an arrow high in the air. It vanished in a flash of flame. "Mithrandir!" he cried. "Mithrandir!"
"Well met, I say to you again, Legolas," said the old man.
They all gazed at him. His hair was white as snow in the sunshine, and gleaming white was his robe. His eyes under his deep brows were bright, piercing as the rays of the sun. Power was in his hand. Between wonder, joy, and fear they stood and found no words to say. At last Aragorn stirred.
"Gandalf," he said, "beyond all hope you return to us in our need. What veil was over my sight? Gandalf!"
Gimli said nothing, but sank to his knees, shading his eyes.
"Gandalf?"
the old man repeated, as if recalling from old memory a long disused word.
"Yes, that was my name. I was Gandalf."
He stepped down from the rock, and picking up his grey cloak, wrapped it about him. It seemed as if the sun had been shining, but now was hid in cloud again.
"Yes, you may still call me Gandalf," he said.
And the voice was the voice of their old friend and guide.
"Get up, my good Gimli. No blame to you, and no harm done to me. Indeed, my friends, none of you have any weapons that could hurt me. Be merry. We meet again, at the turn of the tide. The great storm is coming, but the tide has turned."
He laid his hand on Gimli's head, and the dwarf looked up and laughed suddenly.
"Gandalf," he said, "but you're all in white."
"Yes, I am white now," said Gandalf. "Indeed I am, Saruman, one might almost say. Saruman, as he should have been. But come now, tell me of yourselves.
I've passed through fire and deep water since we parted. I've forgotten much that I thought I knew, and learned again much that I had forgotten. I can see many things far off, but many things that are close at hand I cannot see. Tell me of yourselves."
"What do you wish to know?" said Aragorn.
"All that has happened since we parted on the bridge would be a long tale. Won't you first give us news of the hobbits? Did you find them, and are they safe?" "No, I didn't find them," said Gandalf. "There was a darkness over the valleys of the Emyn Muil, but I did not know of their captivity until the eagle told me."
"The eagle," said Legolas. "I've seen an eagle high and far off. The last time was 3 days ago, above the Emyn Muil."
"Yes," said Gandalf, "that was Gwaihir the Windlord, who rescued me from Orthanc. I sent him before me to watch the river and gather tidings. His sight is keen, but he can't see all that passes under hill and tree. Some things he has seen, and others I've seen myself. The ring now has passed beyond my help, or the help of any of the company that set out from Rivendell. Very nearly it was revealed to the enemy, but it escaped. I had some part in that, for I sat in a high place, and I strove with the dark tower, and the shadow passed. Then I was weary, very weary, and I walked long in dark thought."
"Then you know about Frodo?" said Gimli.
"How do things go with him?"
"I can't say. He was saved from a great peril, but many lie before him still. He resolved to go alone to Mordor, and he set out. That is all that I can say."
"Not alone," said Legolas. "We think that Sam went with him."
"Did he?"
said Gandalf. and there was a gleam in his eye and a smile on his face.
"Did he indeed? It is news to me, yet it doesn't surprise me. Good, very good. You lighten my heart. You must tell me more. Now sit by me and tell me the tale of your journey."
The companions sat on the ground at his feet, and Aragorn took up the tale. For a long while Gandalf said nothing, and he asked no questions. His hands were spread upon his knees, and his eyes were closed. At last, when Aragorn spoke of the death of Boromir and of his last journey upon the great river, the old man sighed.
"You have not said all that you know or guess, Aragorn, my friend," he said quietly. "Poor Boromir. I couldn't see what happened to him. It was a sore trial for such a man, a warrior and a lord of men. Galadriel told me that he was in peril, but he escaped in the end. I am glad. It was not in vain that the young hobbits came with us, if only for Boromir's sake. But that's not the only part they have to play. They were brought to Fangorn, and their coming was like the falling of small stones that starts an avalanche in the mountains. Even as we talk here, I hear the first rumblings. Saruman had best not be caught away from home when the dam bursts."
"In one thing you've not changed, my dear friend," said Aragorn. "You still speak in riddles."
"What, in riddles?" said Gandalf. "No, for I was talking aloud to myself, a habit of the old. They choose the wisest person present to speak to. The long explanations needed by the young are wearying."
He laughed, but the sound now seemed warm and kindly as a gleam of sunshine. "I'm no longer young, even in the reckoning of men of the ancient houses," said Aragorn. "Won't you open your mind more clearly to me?"
"What then should I say?"
said Gandalf, and paused for a while in thought.
"This, in brief, is how I see things at the moment, if you wish to have a piece of my mind as plain as possible. The enemy, of course, has long known that the ring is abroad, and that it's borne by a hobbit. He knows now the number of our company that set out from Rivendell, and the kind of each of us. But he doesn't yet perceive our purpose clearly. He supposes that we were all going to Minas Tirith, for that is what he would himself have done in our place. And according to his wisdom, it would have been a heavy stroke against his power. Indeed, he's in great fear, not knowing what mighty one may suddenly appear, wielding the ring, and assailing him with war, seeking to cast him down and take his place. That we should wish to cast him down, and have no one in his place, is not a thought that occurs to his mind. That we should try to destroy the ring itself has not yet entered into his darkest dream, in which, no doubt, you will see our good fortune and our hopes. For imagining war, he has let loose war, believing that he has no time to waste, for he that strikes the first blow, if he strikes it hard enough, may need to strike no more. So the forces that he has long been preparing he is now setting in motion, sooner than he intended. Wise fool! For if he had used all his power to guard Mordor, so that none could enter, and bent all his guile to the hunting of the ring, then indeed hope would have faded. Neither ring nor bearer could long have eluded him. But now his eye gazes abroad rather than near at home, and mostly he looks towards Minas Tirith. Very soon now his strength will fall upon it like a storm. For already he knows that the messengers that he sent to waylay the company have failed again. They have not found the ring, neither have they brought away any hobbits as hostages. Had they done even so much as that, it would have been a heavy blow to us, and it might have been fatal. But let us not darken our hearts by imagining the trial of their gentle loyalty in the Dark Tower. For the enemy has failed, so far, thanks to Saruman."
"Then is not Saruman a traitor?" said Gimli.
"Indeed, yes," said Gandalf. "Doubly, and is not that strange. Nothing that we have endured of late has seemed so grievous as the treason of Isengard. Even reckoned as a lord and captain, Saruman has grown very strong. He threatens the men of Rohan, and draws off their help from Minas Tirith, even as the main blow is approaching from the east. Yet a treacherous weapon is ever a danger to the hand. Saruman also had a mind to capture the ring, for himself,
or at least to snare some hobbits for his evil purposes. So between them, our enemies have contrived only to bring Merry and Pippin with marvellous speed, and in the nick of time, to Fangorn, where otherwise they would never have come at all. Also, they have filled themselves with new doubts that disturb their plans. No tidings of the battle will come to Mordor, thanks to the horsemen of Rohan, but the Dark Lord knows that two hobbits were taken in the Emyn Muil, and borne away towards Isengard against the will of his own servants. He now has Isengard to fear, as well as Minas Tirith. If Minas Tirith falls, it will go ill with Saruman. "It is a pity that our friends lie in between," said Gimli. "If no land divided Isengard and Mordor, then they could fight while we watched and waited."
"The victory would emerge stronger than either, and free from doubt," said Gandalf.
"But Isengard cannot fight Mordor, unless Saruman first obtains the ring. That he will never do now. He doesn't yet know his peril. There's much that he doesn't know. He was so eager to lay his hands on his prey that he couldn't wait at home, and he came forth to meet and to spy on his messengers. But he came too late, for once, and the battle was over and beyond his help before he reached these parts. He did not remain here long. I look into his mind and I see his doubt. He has no woodcraft. He believes that the horsemen slew and burned all upon the field of battle, but he doesn't know whether the orcs were bringing any prisoners or not. And he doesn't know of the quarrel between his servants and the orcs of Mordor, nor does he know of the winged messenger."
"The winged messenger?" cried Legolas. "I shot at him with the bow of Galadriel above San Geber, and I felled him from the sky. He filled us all with fear. What new terror is this?"
"One that you cannot slay with arrows," said Gandalf. "You only slew his steed. It was a good deed, but the rider was soon horsed again, for he was a Nazgul, one of the nine, who ride now upon winged steeds. Soon their terror will overshadow the last armies of our friends, cutting off the sun. But they have not yet been allowed to cross the river, and Saruman doesn't know of this new shape in which the ringwraiths have been clad. His thought is ever on the ring. Was it present in the battle? Was it found? What if Theoden, Lord of the Mark, should come by it and learn of its power? That's the danger that he sees, and he has fled back to Isengard to double and treble his assault on Rohan. And all the time there is another danger, close at hand, which he doesn't see. Busy with his fiery thoughts, he has forgotten Treebeard."
"Now you speak to yourself again," said Aragorn with a smile. "Treebeard is not known to me, and I have guessed part of Saruman's double treachery. Yet I don't see in what way the coming of two hobbits to Fangorn has served, save to give us a long and fruitless chase."
"Wait a minute," cried Gimli. "There's another thing that I should like to know first. Was it you, Gandalf, or Saruman that we saw last night?"
"You certainly didn't see me," answered Gandalf. "Therefore I must guess that you saw Saruman."
"Evidently we look so much alike that your desire to make an incurable dent in my hat must be excused." "Good, good," said Gimli. "I'm glad that it wasn't you."
Gandalf laughed again.
"Yes, my good dwarf," he said. "It's a comfort not to be mistaken at all points. Do I not know it only too well? But of course, I never blamed you for your welcome of me. How could I do so, who've so often counselled my friends to suspect even their own hands when dealing with the enemy? Bless you, Gimli, son of Gloin. Maybe you will see us both together one day and judge between us."
"But the hobbits," Legolas broke in. "We've come far to seek them, and you seem to know where they are. Where are they now?"
"With Treebeard and the Ents," said Gandalf.
"The Ents!" exclaimed Aragorn. "Then there's truth in the old legends about the dwellers in the deep forests and the giant shepherds of the trees? Are there still Ents in the world? I thought they were only a memory of ancient days, if indeed they were ever more than a legend of Rohan."
"A legend of Rohan!" cried Legolas. "Nay, every elf in Wilderland has sung songs of the old on Odrim and their long sorrow. Yet even among us they're only a memory. If I were to meet one still walking in this world, then indeed I should feel young again. But Treebeard? That is only a rendering of Fangorn into the common speech. Yet you seem to speak of a person. Who is this Treebeard?
Ah, now you are asking much, said Gandalf. The little that I know of his long, slow story would make a tale for which we have no time now. Treebeard is Fangorn, the guardian of the forest. He is the oldest of the Ents, the oldest living thing that still walks beneath the sun upon this middle earth. I hope indeed, Legolas, that you may yet meet him. Merry and Pippin have been fortunate. They met him here, even where we sit. For he came here 2 days ago and bore them away to his dwelling far off by the roots of the mountains. He often comes here, especially when his mind is uneasy, and rumours of the world outside trouble him. I saw him 4 days ago striding among the trees, and I think he saw me, for he paused. But I didn't speak, for I was heavy with thought, and weary after my struggle with the Eye of Mordor. And he didn't speak either, nor call my name. Perhaps he also thought that you were Saruman, said Gimli. But you speak of him as if he was a friend. I thought Fangorn was dangerous. Dangerous, cried Gandalf. And so am I, very dangerous, more dangerous than anything you will ever meet, unless you are brought alive before the seat of the Dark Lord. And Aragorn is dangerous, and Legolas is dangerous. You are beset with dangers, Gimli, son of Gloin, for you are dangerous yourself, in your own fashion. Certainly the forest of Fangorn is perilous, not least to those that are too ready with their axes, and Fangorn himself, he is perilous too. Yet he is wise and kindly nonetheless. But now his long, slow wrath is brimming over, and all the forest is filled with it. The coming of the hobbits and the tidings that they have brought have spilled it. It will soon be running like a flood, but its tide is turned against Saruman and the axes of Isengard. A thing is about to happen which has not happened since the Elder Days. The Ents are going to wake up and find that they are strong.
"What will they do?" asked Legolas in astonishment.
"I don't know," said Gandalf. "I don't think they know themselves. I wonder..."
He fell silent, his head bowed in thought. The others looked at him. A gleam of sun through fleeting clouds fell on his hands, which lay now upturned on his lap. They seemed to be filled with light as a cup is with water. At last he looked up and gazed straight at the sun.
"The morning is wearing away," he said. "Soon we must go."
"Do you go to find our friends and to see Treebeard?" asked Aragorn.
"No," said Gandalf. "That's not the road that you must take. I've spoken words of hope, but only of hope. Hope is not victory. War is upon us and all our friends. A war in which only the use of the ring could give us surety of victory. It fills me with great sorrow and great fear, for much shall be destroyed and all may be lost. I am Gandalf, Gandalf the White, but black is mightier still." He rose and gazed out eastward, shading his eyes, as if he saw things far away that none of them could see. Then he shook his head.
"No," he said in a soft voice. "It has gone beyond our reach. Of that, at least, let us be glad. We can no longer be tempted to use the ring. We must go down to face a peril near despair, yet that deadly peril is removed." He turned. "Come, Aragorn, son of Arathorn," he said. "Don't regret your choice in the valley of the Emynweald, nor call it a vain pursuit. You chose, amid doubts, the path that seemed right. The choice was just, and it has been rewarded, for so we have met in time, who otherwise might have met too late. But the quest of your companions is over. Your next journey is marked by your given word. You must go to Ed Arras and seek out Theoden in his hall, for you are needed. The light of Andúril must now be uncovered in the battle for which it has so long waited. There is war in Rohan, and worse evil. It goes ill with Theoden."
"Then are we not to see the merry young hobbits again?" said Legolas.
"'I didn't say so,' said Gandalf. "'Who knows? Have patience. "'Go where you must go, and hope. "'To Edoras, I go thither also.'
"'It is a long way for a man to walk, young or old,' said Aragorn. "'I fear the battle will be over long ere I come there.'
"'We shall see, we shall see,' said Gandalf. "'Will you come now with me?'
"'Yes, we'll set out together,' said Aragorn. "'But I don't doubt that you'll come there before me, if you wish.'
He rose and looked long at Gandalf. The others gazed at them in silence as they stood there facing one another. The grey figure of the man, Aragorn, son of Arathorn, was tall and stern as stone, his hand upon the hilt of his sword. He looked as if some king out of the mists of the sea had stepped upon the shores of lesser men. Before him stooped the old figure, white, shining now as if with some light kindled within, bent, laden with years, but holding a power beyond the strength of kings.
"'Do I not say truly, Gandalf,' said Aragorn at last, "'that you could go whithersoever you wished quicker than I? "'And this I also say, you are our captain and our banner. "'The Dark Lord has nine, but we have one mightier than they, the White Rider. "'He has passed through the fire and the abyss, and they shall fear him. "'We'll go where he leads.'
"'Yes, together we will follow you,' said Legolas. "'But first it would ease my heart, Gandalf, "'to hear what befell you in Moria. "'Will you not tell us? "'Can you not stay even to tell your friends how you were delivered?'
"'I've stayed already too long,' answered Gandalf. "'Time is short, but if there were a year to spend, "'I wouldn't tell you all.'
"'Then tell us what you will and time allows,' said Gimli. "'Come, Gandalf, tell us how you fared with the Balrog.'
"'Name him not,' said Gandalf,
and for a moment it seemed that a cloud of pain passed over his face, and he sat silent, looking old as death.
"'Long time I fell,'
he said at last, slowly, as if thinking back with difficulty.
"'Long I fell, and he fell with me.' His fire was about me. I was burned. Then we plunged into the deep water, and all was dark. Cold it was as the tide of death. Almost it froze my heart. Deep is the abyss that is spanned by Durin's bridge, and none has measured it, said Gimli. Yet it has a bottom, beyond light and knowledge, said Gandalf. Thither I came at last, to the uttermost foundations of stone. He was with me still. His fire was quenched, but now he was a thing of slime, stronger than a strangling snake. We fought far under the living earth, where time is not counted. Ever he clutched me, and ever I hewed him, till at last he fled into dark tunnels. They were not made by Durin's folk, Gimli, son of Gloin. Far, far below the deepest delvings of the dwarves, the world is gnawed by nameless things. Even Sauron knows them not. They are older than he. Now I have walked there, but I will bring no report to darken the light of day. In that despair my enemy was my only hope, and I pursued him, clutching at his heel. Thus he brought me back at last, to the secret ways of Khazad Dûm. Too well he knew them all. Ever up now we went, until we came to the endless stair. "'Long has that been lost,' said Gimli. "'Many have said that it was never made, save in legend, "'but others say that it was destroyed. "'It was made, and it had not been destroyed,' said Gandalf. "'From the lowest dungeon to the highest peak it climbed, "'ascending an unbroken spiral in many thousand steps, "'until it issued at last in Durin's tower,' carved in the living rock of Ziragzigil, the pinnacle of the Silvertine. There, upon Celebdil, was a lonely window in the snow, and before it lay a narrow space, a dizzy eyrie above the mists of the world. The sun shot fiercely there, but all below was wrapped in cloud. Out he sprang, and ever as I came behind, he burst into flame. There was none to see, or perhaps in after ages songs would still be sung of the Battle of the Peak.
Suddenly Gandalf laughed.
But what would they say in song?
Those that looked up from afar thought that the mountain was crowned with storm. Thunder they heard, and lightning, they said, smote upon Celebdil, and leaped back, broken into tongues of fire. Is that not enough? A great smoke rose about us, vapour and steam. Ice fell like rain. I threw down my enemy, and he fell from the high place, and broke the mountainside where he smote it in his ruin. Then darkness took me, and I strayed out of thought and time, and I wandered far on roads that I will not tell. Naked I was sent back for a brief time, until my task is done. And naked I lay upon the mountain top. The tower behind was crumbled into dust. The window was gone. The ruined stair was choked with burned and broken stone. I was alone, forgotten, without escape upon the hard horn of the world. There I lay staring upward, while the stars wheeled over, and each day was as long as a life-age of the earth. Faint to my ears came the gathered rumour of all lands, the springing and the dying, the song and the weeping, and the slow everlasting groan of overburdened stone. And so at the last, Gwaihir the Windlord found me again, and he took me up and bore me away. "Ever am I fated to be your burden, friend at need," I said. "A burden you have been," he answered, "but not so now. Light as a swan's feather in my claw you are. The sun shines through you. Indeed, I do not think you need me any more. Were I to let you fall, you would float upon the wind." "Do not let me fall," I gasped, for I felt life in me again. "Bear me to Lothlorien." "That indeed is the command of the Lady Galadriel, who sent me to look for you," he answered. "Thus it was that I came to Carras Galathon, and found you but lately gone. I tarried there in the ageless time of that land, where days bring healing, not decay. Healing I found, and I was clothed in white. Counsel I gave, and counsel took. Thence by strange roads I came, and messages I bring to some of you. To Aragorn I was bidden to say this. Where now are the Dúnedain? Elisar, Elisar, why do thy kinsfolk wander afar? Near is the hour when the lost should come forth, and the grey company ride from the north. But dark is the path appointed for thee, the dead watch the road that leads to the sea. To Legolas she sent this word. Legolas, Greenleaf, long under tree, in joy thou hast lived. Beware of the sea. If thou hearest the cry of the gull on the shore, thy heart shall then rest in the forest no more.
This ends Disc 4.